Chapter 14. Ulinor, Gorkogrod, Inner Palace. Teleportation was an experience that Courland counted, his own near death on Adamantia and subsequent bloody resurrection very much included, as one of rare horror. Every atom in his body felt as if it had been electrified, charge repulsion bearing his basic substance to the warp. Then the quarks and gluons that constituted those creaking atoms separating until he was a physical thing only in the abstract. He was atomic spaces, constrained only by the memory of nuclear cohesion. He was a nebula cloud, spread across the infinite, haunted by the unbearable thought of one day collapsing to form a star. Then movement, but without body. It felt like his soul was forced through an electrostatic mesh, like gruel being strained through muslin. But the substance was what was caught in the membrane, and he was the discolored diluent that trickled through. From that weak suffusion of molecular memory and psychic tangling, there came a reformation. And it was A, not the. Everything was contingent. What emerged, and how, was in the lap of the gods. The blinding light of teleportation faded, the disembodied sense of half-remembered dread following slowly, like blood trickling through a drain. Courland's primary heart was pounding as though he had been engaged in some extraordinary struggle that he could not now recall. The teleportation chamber was gone. In its place, displayed by his suit's auto-senses in augmented definition, was a dank, flame-lit room. The ruddy heat of open stoves was reflected in the beaten metal fronts of cabinets from the brutally large, blunted implements that hung on pegs from the walls. Half-heartedly mopped-up bloodstains smeared the floor and the surfaces. Pots bubbled, ill-fitting lids chattering. A hunk of meat, what looked like a sawed-through stretch of vertebral column dripping from the end, dripped fat onto a sizzling element and rotated on a jerky mechanical spit. Courland's armour recorded the intense heat while insulating him from it, and the effects of the uncertain light were evenly filtered and restored. The smell, however, was all too readily imagined. Asger Warfist lowered his lightning claws. A wary sniff crackled through the unit vox, instinctual in spite of the total environment seal of tactical dreadnought armor. This is no throne room. Ulinor, Gorkogrod. Inquisitor Venand tapped her foot impatiently as a gang of servitors broke open a crate and spilled wire foam cladding across the floor. It contained a portable vox caster. Another was being installed directly opposite, part of two banks of units being wired up in series. Inquisitorial technical staff opened diagnostic channels and made expert reconfigurations inside open panels stuffed with what looked to Venand like tangles of cabling. Nemagos supervised, hunched under his or her, difficult to tell, acid-stained red robes. The occasional flicker of a servo appendage switched across to furiously undo and redo someone's work. "Castellan Claremont strike force coming under heavy fire in Sector 12B," said one of the Vox operators.
"12B," said Venand. "Do they plan to take the palace on their own? Redeploy kill teams Godwin and Phobos to clear the adjoining blocks and raise the Castellan if you can."
"Yes, Representative."
The vox-breaking interference between the surface and the fleet was something that Imperial forces had contended with during the previous invasion. At Venan's insistence and Asger's approval, something had been done about it. The chamber that her small command detail had occupied as a surface monitoring post was a level between levels in one of the hundreds of Gretchen Hab towers that prickled the cityscape in the palace's immediate vicinity. To supply their orc overlords with workers, Venand assumed. Terror was organized with similar considerations in mind. This particular floor was unoccupied, empty but for thick, shock-absorbent clamps and structuromimetic columns that enabled this structure and others like it to remain upright through the awesome stresses of tectonic rearrangement or subspace translation. The tower was the tallest in the battle zone that wasn't part of the palace itself and had been selected for that reason. Servitors and techno-magi trailed clumps of cabling and complex adapter tablets behind them to exposed wall panels. From there, they cross-connected Venan's equipment through the tower's own messy electrical systems to the dishes, antennae, and non-geometric pylons that flourished over the spire top like fungoid weeds. Veritas would have found the cross-wiring of technologies a borderline act of heresy. But that was why the ancient Inquisitor had remained on Terra and let Venan's operatives do the work that he could not. From the lower-level access ramps there came the sputtering hiss of superheated metal. A servitor with a melter tool fitted to its wrist in place of a hand, and a fuel canister integrated into its spinal column, welded the zigzagging door seal together, calm under fire, as only a thorough lobotomization could make something that had once been human. The muffled roar of two twin-linked heavy bolters from the other side of the door did not trouble it in the least. The fate of the two Praetorian-class servitors was a far less concern to the servitor than it was to Venand.
"I seem to recall Lord Worfis telling you to observe from behind our assault."
The Death Watch sergeant, Kjavik Stormcrow, stood with crossed arms, deliberately in the middle of a team of workers trying to assemble a tactical hololith where he was standing. His long, bone-braided hair spread over the dark curves of pauldron and guard brace. Several weeks aboard Abhorrence had acclimated Venand to the stature and bearing of the Adeptus Astartes, but they were all far from alike. The Black Templars held themselves tall, unbending, like pillars of rock-crete with proud human faces. The Space Wolf was not like that. He was ever so slightly hunched over, an animal at its ease, his annoyance at Umbra being drawn from active assignment to safeguard the Inquisitorial representative on as yet untried authority, an unguarded glimmer in his inhuman eyes.
"Do you always do as Lord Asgher tells you?"
"Often," said Kjavik,
then grinned. Venand made herself smile in turn. She might just win these warriors' respect yet.
"Initial soundings from the Auspex," said
Raznik, veering loosely between the hurrying workers to approach. He was wearing a long coat over a dull green flak jacket, surplus to some regiment or other from the Ullinor veterans. There was a brace of pistols, holstered at his hip, needle and las, and a sleeve for a power maul. The battery pack for a two-person refractor field was clamped over his right buttock, the emitters set into a pair of braces worn over his ballistic vest. Bodyguarding for the Inquisitorial representative was testing work at the best of times. Kjavik regarded him like a bear at once amused and annoyed by the barked challenge of a dog. The Inquisitorial aide swallowed and turned to Venand.
"Issachar has the Orc fleet engaged, but is keeping them at arm's length. Losses appear light on both sides. Alcazar Remembered and her escorts are in geostationary orbit above the corridor opened up by the Death Watch."
A nod to Kjavik, and the wolf acknowledged with a snarl.
"From the power signatures, it looks as though one teleportation cycle has been completed."
"Corlan's first squad is inside," Venand summarized.
"On schedule."
Venand frowned. She wasn't ready to start taking Corlan's undemonstrated ability to outwit the beast on faith.
"We should have them on Vox by now."
"We're almost finished here, Representative," said one of the workers at the hololith array.
A dozen men were busily boxing up the device's exposed innards, while a second Magos canted the final start-up rituals. Eldon Urquidex helped where he could. The Magos biologist limped slightly. A string of bionic vertebrae now ran down his neck, a gunmetal accoutrement to match the left arm, the right hand, and the surgical plates in his skull. The hololith powered up. Ullinor's wrinkled topography flickered into being as a spectral green overlay, rapidly filling up with blips as it liaised with the Auspexes to present troop dispositions. Venand watched the shift in the tide of Veridi red with her heart in her mouth. Her first thought was to instruct the adept to shut the device down and begin his rituals again. Its spirit had been improperly awakened. It had to be. Only her trust in the two Magi's superior knowledge kept her from doing so.
"I'll be damned," Kjavik grunted. "The Orcs are disengaging, falling back towards the palace fortification."
The voice was Raznik's, his summation unnecessary. Venand had eyes, and the great withdrawal of red across the hololith like a receding tide spoke for itself.
"This is no rout," said Kjavik, indicating with jabs of his power fist's wolf claws to where overwhelming numbers still hemmed in the frayed wedge of gold that represented Maximus Thane's contingent. "They have left enough force behind to hold up the guard."
"But why not crush them? Why pull back at all? Why?"
Venand waved her hand, as if to summon the absent thought. The boom of heavy bolters from the other side of the doors was an urgent distraction that she could do without. A symphony of audially coded alarm signifiers began to chime from the Auspex units.
"Force fields have just gone up inside the palace, representative," came the report.
"Inside?"
"Yes, nothing projected outward that I can detect."
"What on the throne? Can we raise Courland?"
A shake of the head.
"Some kind of signal deflection. The force fields, I think. I don't know."
"Then raise Issachar. See what the fleet's guns can do about it."
"No response from Punished.
Try another ship."
A tense moment later, and several rows of shaken heads told Venand that the answer was the same. The Magos held up his digital manipulators in what was either a residually organic gesture of ignorance or an affectation painstakingly developed for maximal functionality as a human liaison.
"The fleet is in range of this structure's communications array. Supposition, we are too close to the palace. The electromagnetic output from its force fields is interfering with our equipment."
"Contact Thane,"
Venand scowled, feeling her command of the situation unravelling fast.
"Do it now. He'll have no idea what's going on, and he might at least have a chance to fall back and regroup. No point walking into a slaughter for no good reason."
The operator looked up from his voxcaster. He looked broken.
"We can't reach our ground forces either."
A solid thump from the other side of the low access doors interrupted them, and the roar of four heavy bolters abruptly became that of two. Venand would not have thought that the difference would have been so obvious. Stray slugs tapped on the welded door, almost politely. The last weapon servitor would not hold for long, and then Venand would see close up just how impolite an orc could be.
"Madam Inquisitor," called the ranking officer monitoring the Auspex staff, "more ships entering Auspex range."
"There shouldn't be any more ships."
"Orc ships, 100 signatures at least. They must have been waiting on the planet's Auspex dark side."
Venand felt a chill rise up through her and whisper round the base of her skull. The monitoring station had fallen deathly quiet, but for the much diminished thunder of heavy bolters. She swallowed, unable to articulate the cornered animal sensation that had come over her with the appearance of those orc ships.
"What shall we do?"
asked Raznik. Dumbly, she looked around the silent chamber, her eyes drawn inevitably, water running downhill, to Kjavik's yellow, vertically transected pair. She took a deep breath, felt it steady her nerves, and did not blink. She still had a task to perform, even if the total lack of long and medium-range vox made that task impossible.
"Leave everything," she said,
directed at the two magi, and then to Kjavik and Raznik.
"Contact any gunships in range, and have them pick up the remaining kill teams. I'm going to have to direct things in person."
Ulanor, Gorkogrod. As Courland had suspected, the pre-teleportation position and facing of his squad members had had little bearing on how they were now deployed. The 12 of them had rematerialized into two half-circles facing outwards, a row of blue-white burners and butchery tools between them. He, Asger, Krul, and the Ogryn Olug had the two semicircles' four ends. Commissar Goss was being violently sick. Courland did not know if it was the teleportation or the stench, but he doubted that either would have been easy on a mortal stomach.
"Where are we?" said Asger. "Why are we not where we are supposed to be?"
With a blink click over the activational rune jittering yellow in his helm display, Courland bade his armor's spirit to summon a Tri-D cartolith of the palace complex. It wavered into being a moment later, filling the left side of the display with a slowly rotating image. It took a few minutes to interface his armor's locator beacon and the cartolith and pin his current location to the display towards the top of the labyrinthine tangle of corridors.
"About 400 meters from the throne room, though the corridors in this section are a mess. What happened?" "Force fields on my Auspex," said Beaumont. "A scatter field too, perhaps. Our teleport must have been redirected to avoid it."
Courland blew out a relieved breath. The teleport systems incorporated safety protocols to prevent incorporation into solid matter or other violent means of rematerialization, but even First Company veterans did not hold much trust in those. He was glad to see they had functioned now, even if they had moved his squad some way from his target.
"What of Cavallinera's team?"
Asger shrugged. Only his exposed head moved.
If this is the nearest area to the throne room large enough for 12 men, then the sisters will likely be redirected here. How long to teleport? Kronos, do not operate during the teleportation cycle, said Beaumont. I cannot contact Alcazar, remember, to correct. Outward channels appear to be jammed. Then we must clear the area, said Curran sharply, or else there will be no telling where the others will appear. Krul, can you find your way to the throne room from here?
The assassin was subconsciously scouring his surrounds for threats and targets, but responded to the question with a curt nod and pointed to one of two doors. He was a large man by mortal standards, but moved with a balletic grace. The firelight scattered against his sin-skin.
Sergeant Tyrus, escort him and secure the passage. We will follow.
The Death Watch Space Marines, Ogryns, Commissar, Terminator-encased Chapter Masters, and one assassin exited the chamber. Courland stopped under the lintel bar and turned ponderously to look back. He had felt a prickling on the back of his neck. The air of the Orc's butchery chamber shimmered and folded, a kneading of the warp space liminal that broke the warm, surface-hardened crust of normalcy to which mankind thought it clove and mixed it with darkness. The tear existed for a fraction of a second, and in a splurge of ionization that left Corlin's eyes and throat stinging in spite of his protection, it was sealed, and 12 additional figures now stood where there had been none. Cavalinera and 5 of her sisters stood in a ring with power blades drawn and charged. Torn pages of ancient scripture fluttered from their armor in the air-cycled breeze of a void ship they no longer occupied. 2 were in the same antique carmine as the Night Abyssal, designating them, presumably, as belonging to the same suborder of the Sisters of Silence. The other 3 wore black plate with golden trim, led by Knight Obsidian by the name of Dravina. The chilling effect on Corlin's brain of the pariah's mere existence in the same room was every bit as profound as the teleportation cycle that had preceded it. The women surrounded the Orc Psyker. It was far larger than the Incus Maximal test subject, and its muscles swelled against the chains that bound its wrist and throat. 3 enormously reconstructed draft servitors, supplied from Verisimilis's loading decks, had the ends of the chains clamped in vice hands. Another lesson from Incus Maximal. The servitors were more than strong enough to keep the struggling Orc restrained, and they would not react to personal danger the way the inquisitorial stormtroopers had. Laurentis scuttled around them on his 3 metal legs, ducking under flexing chains, monitoring pulse and breathing, and stabbing the Orc's thick hide with digital probes for reasons of his own. The grizzled ranger, Alpha 13 Jazal, watched the Orc Psyker's occasional lunges with a dispassionate eye, motionless but for the optic pulse of the complete wavelength scan with which he concurrently swept the room. "Scan complete," grated Alpha 13 Jazal. The words were synthesized by a throat implant and emerged with an artificial cadence that involved neither the movement of the ranger's jaw nor the making of eye contact.
"Infrared and X-ray sweeps reveal nothing in the vicinity."
His head turned sharply towards Corlin then, faceted metal reflecting the firelight on a dozen different planes.
"Past behavior suggests the high likelihood of a trap."
The same thing had occurred to Corlin, and he had decided equally quickly that it did not matter. They were committed now. There was no alternative. Ulanor would be annihilated, or Terra would be. Ulanor, Gorkogrod. Shards of sharpened debris from Orc fragmentation bombs scythed across Thane's armor. Bent nails, metal scraps. Direct hits drove shrapnel at him, hard, licked by fire. Cloudbursts clotted the sky with whizzing screws and blades, raining indiscriminately over all. The high-tempo thump of heavy guns boomed through the fragstorm. Thane's battleplate recorded hits as he advanced through the rubble. Prangs, stings, chips to unpainted ceramite that brought sealant gel hissing over lodged bullets. His Umbra pattern bolter answered back with more decisive effect. His helmet auto-senses compensated for the confusion of debris, filtering ghostly reticules floating amongst the blizzarding buckshot. Bolter fire bracketed the faceplate ghosts one by one, and blood sprayed from within them. Orcs tumbled out as though pushed out in surrender, rolling with the unspent momentum of their charge, tracked by Bolt and Laz until what lumped to a halt was an unrecognizable ruin. Thane drilled a bolt round through a mouth that was somehow still sucking on air. The orc made a grunting sound, the subsequent detonation pasting Thane's right greave with gore as he stepped over it.
Theseus! Agrippus! Heavy weapons left and right!
He pointed a gauntlet that was hatched with sealant scars towards a high spiked tower. Burning rounds spat back and forth. He ducked instinctively from the whistle of an artillery shell.
Venerable Brother Otho, take a squad and help the excoriators clear that tower. I want a corridor cleared for the Imperial Guard to follow. We are too thinly spread.
The Earthshaker round thumped through the side wall of a building and spewed fire high back across the street. The famous aftershock rattled the entire connected superstructure. The excoriators had broken into the barracks blocks to the east, but had become mired in heavy urban fighting. Gun nests covering the bridge walks and exits had them pinned in the complex's near side corner, while hit-and-run attacks by aerially deployed orc shock troops, coordinated with armoured units on the ground, slowly ate into that slim territorial gain. But the excoriators would hold. Venerable Brother Otho would see to it. To north and west, the Black Templars continued to drive deep. Before passing out of Vox contact, Castellan Clermont had voxed in from a position almost 3 kilometres from Curran's teleport coordinates, practically on the walls. But the Black Templars had been so intent on pressing forwards that entire mobs of orcs had been able to slip through and assault the Fist's Exemplar flank. Theseus's autocannon mowed them down before they could come within 20 metres. Brothers Ptolemy, Preco, and Zaul moved into the kill zone, cutting into the building fronts with precise bursts of bolter fire. None of them saw the shell before it landed. Thane did. It was unworthy of them, a lumpen metal casing for something incendiary, lobbed carelessly from a shanty block as if from a trebuchet. But it blasted a mighty hole out of the ground, as well as any handcrafted munition blessed by the priests of Mars. And just like that, the galaxy had 69 Fist's Exemplar.
There are few of us left, Thane had said,
looking through the viewport at the dense stellar clouds of the galactic core in which the Ulanor star shone with a bright, beguiling innocence.
Barely enough to continue.
Courland had joined them. The lumen bars in the mullions accentuated the grey in his hair.
We are sons of Dawn, brother. We do not surrender.
He had tapped his throat, Thane remembered. The progenoids held there the last precious gene seed of his chapter.
That is the burden the Primarch has placed on us. He knew we could shoulder it. We stand while all around us falls, and because we stand, others will stand with us. Call for Apothecary Antonius,
yelled Thamarius, because every Fist Exemplar carried in his makeup the conceit of command. Antonius was of the excoriators, attached to the remnant Fist Exemplar to perform that most vital function, in the absence of a surviving apothecary of their own.
Press the attack,
Thane ordered, emotionless, gunning down an orc that appeared in an unglazed window even as his brothers turned their helms to him in surprise. They would stand while all around them fell. They wore no colours, they showed no pride, but to a transhuman man, they were the truest sons of Dawn.
Whirlwinds, he shouted. I want that block brought down.
Thane could see the greater picture despite the slaughter. He knew the mathematics. The chapter had been hit too hard, its gene stocks depleted beyond their ability to propagate a viable genetic population. The last wall stood, but the Fist's Exemplar were already finished. A column of Death Watch vehicles, scuffed paintwork revealing the bright green of the Aurora chapter, trundled up towards the front. The rubble was causing them difficulty, the cavalcade advancing at less than walking pace behind a pair of Vindicators specially modified with urban clearance dozer blades. Both of the Glacis modules were pocked by bullet holes. One of them was on fire. The desultory whistle of Castellan missiles and las cannon stabs were all they could give back. With a sonic clap and a Promethean roar, an atmosphere fighter with rippling flames chased in paint down its stub nose dropped through the frag clouds and strafed the armor column with a linked pair of underwing quad autocannons. High-volume anti-personnel rounds spanked and rattled among armor plates, blood splashing across the turret of a Razorback as its commander vainly tried to track the jet with his pintle mount, and then, in a rumble of afterburn, it raced northwards into Ork-held territory. 2 or 3 kilometers in that direction, where it had been driven to keep pace with the Black Templar's advance, Thane could see the great 15-meter-high pyre that had been Hellfire. In the glare of that inferno, the invincible Decimus Ordinatus shimmered in a liquid call of purples and greens, tormented from every angle by sustained fire. As Thane watched, the warlord raised an arm stained with pyrotechnic bruising, the diverted power causing its Gatling blaster to glow like a birthing sun. The massive weapon began to spin, superfast, oddly silent, against the cacophonies more immediate in Thane's ears, and disgorged a blast of energy that carved the nearest of the offending gun towers in two. That beam of light was, in fact, a torrent of several million high-power las beams per second, and the combined effect was devastating. The Titan dragged its arm diagonally across its body, chewing downwards through the blasted structure and overloading the shields of the pot-bellied orc gargant that had been sheltering behind it. The Gatling blaster gave out with a splutter of light and a spent whirr of barrels as the remains of the gun tower crumbled down over the bright yellow body of the unshielded gargant. The orc machine drove through it, a lunatic grin in brilliant yellow over its crude orcish face. Behind it came several more. Decimus Ordinatus shook the earth with a backward step. "After today, there might be no Children of Dawn," Thane had said, not in argument, but the words needed to be said. They were greater than him.
"No wall stands forever, brother. But I think that our father's legacy was always about more than us. If Vulcan taught me anything, it was to have faith. Humanity will prevail as it always has. It is for those like us to ensure that it is so."
Thane cursed on the Eidolican day as something unseen but earth-shakingly massive impacted somewhere in the conurbation near enough to rattle his boots against the ground. He dropped to one knee in a crater and unloaded his magazine, speaking evenly and calmly into his helmet box. "This is Force Commander Thane to all units still receiving. Consolidate at the second marker and await." A rocket screamed across from a tower block and struck the lead vindicator side-on between the dozer blade and the track. The explosion flipped it over, with fingers of flame and nails of smoke onto its back, smashing through the glacis armor of the vehicle behind.
"Brother Agrippus,"
Thane finished, debris raining down. His battle brother tracked the aim of his heavy bolter round to the right and speared the crude rocket's winding smoke tail with bunker-busting incendiary rounds. Thane saw a burly orc with a flared missile tube under one arm running window to window. Behind Thane's back, the rest of the Aurora Chapter's armor column snarled up into a congested huddle of vehicles behind the stricken Vindicator. Angry shouts and engine growls. The orc shooter crashed through a sidewall and into an alley just as Agrippus's heavy bolter tore up the last window in the row. It dropped, hanging onto its missile tube as though it doubled as a jump pack, and thumped two-footed onto the rear axle suspension of a waiting truck. Wood and metal shards sprayed over the vehicle as it roared into a wheel spin and rattled off between the blocks, bolt rounds spanking from its rear fender. Thane's Lyman's ear tuned to the sounds of orc vehicles, fighters being picked up and redeployed, unhappy about it by the tone of their Xenos grunts, but obedient to their leaders. He mentally reconfigured his mind map of the battlefield. The orcs were refocusing their forces along a narrower front, digging in somewhere just ahead of the Black Templar's advance.
"They are withdrawing." "An unlikely but predicted variable," said Brother Gehagnis. "Substitute stratagem is staged advance. Pull Black Templars back and extend flanks with Astra Militarum units. Draw the orcs onto us again."
Thane took a moment to consider, to elevate his mind above the anarchy of the battlefield, to perceive in it the connections of cause and effect, as every Fist's Exemplar initiate was taught. Every possibility was considered. Every variable already had a strategy in place to counter it. There had been no regicide sets on Idolica, and no one would ever challenge a Fist exemplar to a game of strategy. These orcs had shown a fondness for feints and counters. Perhaps it was time to show them something they did not expect.
"Vulcan had faith in you, brother," Thane had answered. "He had faith in us all."
Corland had turned from the window then and lain a gauntleted hand on Thane's shoulder. Half his face was dark, shielded from the viewport's lumen bars like a planet's nightside.
"As I do. We fight to the last. We are the ultimate realization of the hopes of mankind, and by our virtues do we hold humanity's leaders to account. In heart and mind, we never waver."
He released his grip and appeared to sigh, though made no sound.
"The real work begins tomorrow and the day after. We will rebuild the Imperium, brother. If one day the Khan or the Raven should be found, as Vulcan was, if the Emperor should awake, then I would have the Imperium that they find be one of glory and not despair. I would make our father proud. Pull back the Black Templars, but then throw everything into the Excoriator's flank, even the reserves. That is not the correct stratagem for this set of conditions," Kahagnis argued.
Thane's expression was immobile as rock as he regarded the spires and gun turrets of the idolatrous palace complex, still several kilometers away. The orcs knew that Corland was inside, and somehow, though he had not yet worked the problem through that far, his and Corland's roles of lure and trap had become reversed. Were it in his nature to do so, he might have smiled.
"The objective is the same, brother," said Thane.
Kill the beast. It did not matter who did it, and Thane had no intention of becoming the last son of Dawn. Ulanor, Gorkogrod, Inner Palace. The Ogryn, Brock, punched the locked door. Ripples of blue-green force spilled outward from the giant abhuman's grinding knuckles, and the force field cloaking the door gave an ozone sputter. The Ogryn's muscles bulged as he tried to force it. Sweat soaked his khaki vest. After a few seconds of straining, the Ogryn withdrew his hand and shook out his seared knuckles, dog tags and chains clinking against the spit-polished campaign medals sewn into his jacket breast. Laurentius's plasma cutters had failed to make a mark either. So had Asger's lightning claws. To look at the door was to look at something clearly orc. The metal was thick and clamped in the middle by a meaty lock in the shape of a bull-horned greenskin. The black and white diagonal stripes were garishly done, the brushstrokes occasionally veering off the line to create a weird, kaleidoscopic pattern. The doors, however, were well balanced on their runners. The join was perfectly centered, and then there was the force field. Laurentius lifted an extensor that emerged from his robes on an articulated limb and tapped on the door at various points, like a medic maneuvering his stethoscope as he palpated a patient's chest. Small flowerings of counterforce rippled from around his bladed metal probe.
"Supposition, a nano-layer force field, similar in concept to the adamantine surface layer of Thunderhawk or Land Raider armor."
He tapped it again and watched the spread of colors.
"Fascinating."
"Can it be broken?" asked Corland.
"Undoubtedly."
"Can you break it?"
"Oh, I think not. Not without further investigation."
Corland nodded in acceptance, though his helm, bonded to his plastron and pauldrons, did not translate it well, and turned ponderously around. The corridor was of the same unidentifiable metal as the door, super-resistant, unmarked by the scrape of a lightning claw or the frustrated discharge of a commissar's plasma pistol, but minus the paintwork or the energy field. It was remarkably clean. There was no light source that any of them could detect, and there was no sign of external power generation. Every surface just seemed to glow with a soft, bluish light. Embossed plates and glyphs marked junctions and doorways. Cavalinera and her sisters filled the corridor with raised swords, a shield of exquisite warplate and power-edged blades between Laurentius and Alpha 13 Jazal and the servitor-restrained Orksiker. Asger held the rear. The second Ogryn and Commissar Goss stood at one of the junctions. This door was unshielded, and Beaumont was already on the other side with Kill Team's Stalker. Courland glanced again at the cartolith. His current location was identified by a small pulsing icon buried deep into a labyrinthine subterranean structure that more nearly resembled the root system of a tooth than anything obviously palatial. Passageways spread out from his position like capillaries. It looked like they were in the midsection of a raised structure, one of several fortified edifices that ringed the beast's throne room. His best guess put them 100 meters or so above it, and about twice that horizontally. "The strange thing," Krul appeared by Corlin's pauldron and gestured to the open door, "is that that's the more direct route. The palace itself is movable. Are you certain? I wouldn't open my mouth otherwise." Trap, Alpha 13 Jazal said again, a Voxloop growl. Courland wondered if Rogel Dorn had smiled when he had first set foot on Sebastus IV. Of course it is a trap.
If I might propose a theory?
Laurentis scuttled around from the locked and shielded door to face Courland, audio receivers extending from his cranial structure, as if, in some remotely human way, to present himself fully at the Space Marine's disposal.
"I remember a time when you would not have cared to ask first," said Courland.
"I have, on occasion, been made aware that my hypotheses are not at all times relevant or welcome."
"They are today, my friend. Speak."
Laurentis blinked and lowered his eyeball, a gesture of humble gratitude.
"The sole purpose of our mission is the assassination of the beast, correct?"
Courland nodded.
"To eliminate the one target that the enemy cannot afford to lose."
Laurentis quoted in paraphrase, then nodded Fidus Bellator's huge pectoral aquila with a manipulator claw.
"It occurs to me that the beast could have a similar thought."
"The mission is compromised," said Alpha 13 Jazal. "You have been lured here."
Courland regarded the cyberguised warrior sternly. The Skitarius knew, because Courland had shared the data himself, of the Calculus Logi's latest prognoses. Terra had been calculated to collapse in a matter of weeks. The most optimistic upper limit of statistical deviation had the Greater Imperium continuing as a unified entity for only another few months at best. These facts were no secret. Let the ugly face of failure inspire the mortals to sacrifice all, as Thane and the Last Wall did, mere kilometers away.
"It changes nothing." "We should at least contact Thane or Issachar," said Krul, "or both. If you're right, then Vox silence is clearly unnecessary."
"Impossible,"
came Beaumont's voice-amplified reply from the adjoining corridor. The Black Templar clumped back into view, bulging armor plates blued by the odd, rinsing light.
"External Vox is being blocked. Did Corlin not tell you?"
Krul puffed out his cheeks.
"Then I suppose I'm with that."
He jabbed his head sideways towards Alpha 13 Jazal.
"I've been this way before without losing outside contact. It has to be deliberate." "I assume then that your opinion is the same," said Beaumont.
Krul's expression was stony. His eyes widened slightly, and the whites began to turn red. Without appearing to move, his musculature noticeably swelled under his sin-skin body glove. Chronaxic implants, Courland reasoned, threat-responsive, doping the assassin's already enhanced physiognomy with a sharp increase in metabolism. Krul grinned like a snake.
"We came all this way. I brought all my favourite knives."
"Kill Ork for Emperor,"
rumbled Olog slowly.
Courland felt his heart warm with gratitude.
"Signal on my Auspex," growled Asgar suddenly. 50 meters that way."
He pointed one set of lightning claws down the corridor. Cavalinera and her sisters made ready with a swift rustle of oiled plates.
"Closing, with some haste."
"How many?" said Courland.
"Enough for me."
"It seems that the Auspex is working after all," said Laurentis happily.
"Ave bloody omnissiah," muttered Krul.
"Praise him,"
Laurentis agreed.
"Break through them,"
suggested Alpha 13 Jazal, "while we are still capable of salvaging the weapon. There is no way of ascertaining from here whether this route to the throne room will not be similarly
warded.
But somehow, Kurland knew that it would not be. The Emperor lit the galaxy through the Astronomicon. Was it not then possible that he watched over his children in spirit?
Cruel, Tyrus, you have point. Beaumont, with them. Asger, you know what to do if the orcs catch up.
The Wolf Lord flexed his lightning claws eloquently.
Goss, covering fire. Lady Brissanus, Laurentis, you're with me.